This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again. In Revelation chapter 17, the Bible speaks of a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, and on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And she was drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. Now, by Revelation 18, Babylon has fallen, having become a dwelling place of demons. But what does it all mean? Who is this woman and the beast? And what exactly is Babylon? And is that a literal reference or just a prediction of a kingdom to come? And why does understanding these two chapters matter so much? We're going to tackle it today with Joel Richardson, internationally recognized expert on biblical prophecy, the Middle East and Islam, commentator for WND, and author of the really fascinating book he's just come out with, Mystery Babylon, Unlocking the Bible's Greatest Prophetic Mystery. Joel, so great to have you here. How are you?
Very good, Janet. Thanks for having me back.
Thank
you. Interesting topic this week.
Oh, fascinating. I'm so glad you're here because I have wondered, who is this woman? And I've read all sorts of opinions and all sorts of biblical prophecy experts have weighed in. What is so important, would you say, about this passage, Revelation 17 and 18?
Well, first of all, this is the longest prophecy in the New Testament. And of course, it comprises two of the final few chapters of the entire Bible. You know, there's so many pastors out there that just, they won't touch it. They don't think it's relevant. I'm convinced it's very relevant. This is going to be a very real geopolitical entity that has profound influence over much of the earth in the last days. And so, of course, if we are living in the last days, which I do believe we are, I think it's important for the body of Christ to try to wrestle through these things. And that's exactly what I do in the book. And I work through all of the various popular interpretations and try to weigh the strengths and the weaknesses, and not in an overly dogmatic or dramatic, sensationalized way. I offer a solution which I think will shock a lot of people, but which really does make a lot of sense.
Yes, I can't wait to get to that. But when we talk about the beginning of Revelation 17, where one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with John, saying, I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. How do you figure out who the great harlot is within the context of the book of Revelation and what we know about the time period? How do you even begin to try to figure that out?
Well, you know, whenever you have these very complicated, symbolic, apocalyptic passages throughout the Bible, the angel, there's always an angelic messenger that comes and really explains it. Now, of course, he says this requires wisdom, and, you know, we have to really wade through it, but he lays out a series of various criteria of different requirements, and we analyze those requirements, we lay them all out, and the principle that I worked from is the idea that if you go to a store and you buy a glove, it's not good enough if 3 of the fingers in that glove just fit really fantastic, and that's really the case with some of the interpretations, but then a couple others don't fit. We need to lay out all the criteria and then weigh the various options and say which one fits best.
Right. Now, is there one popular view of this particular passage that tends to be more accepted than others? In other words, what are some of the options that people have put forward as to the identity of the woman?
Sure. Well, of course, because since the Reformation, much of Protestantism has looked to the Vatican, the city of Rome.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in the past few years, there have been quite a lot of believers who have interpreted this passage as referring to New York City or the United States. And, of course, that has dramatic pastoral implications because, I mean, it says right in the prophecy, flee from her. And so, of course, if the United States is Mystery Babylon, well, then we have a prophecy that tells all believers to get out.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I have some pretty serious problems with that interpretation. First of all, you could look at New York City, Wall Street, and say it's a very powerful economic influence of the earth, of course, but it's missing one of the most essential components, which is the religious component. And Revelation is not just talking about something like materialism or humanism. It's talking about a religious system which is primarily responsible for the shed blood of the saints throughout the earth.
Wow.
And, you know, that's very difficult. The United States is still, for all its faults, the greatest missionary sending nation in the earth, accounting for 80% of both the missionaries and the funding for the gospel going throughout the earth. When Babylon falls, it commands all of the saints to rejoice that her destruction has come. If the United States fell today, I don't think this would be something that heaven would be rejoicing over.
Yeah, great point. Well, when you talk about the reformers, for example, Lutherans to this day would say Rome is the Antichrist, and they point to verse 9 of chapter 17, talking about the seven mountains and the hills, you know, the seven hills of Rome and all that. How does somebody get to New York City, though? I mean, why New York City? Because of the immorality? Or those who hold to that, what are they basing that on?
Well, again, they base it on this idea of a city that sits on many waters. So you have some initial descriptions. Like I said, a couple of the fingers seem to fit. And she seems to be this greatest source of influence all over the earth and corrupting influence. And they go, well, of course, nothing is as powerful as the United States. And in many ways, I think you could argue that the United States is sort of like the Rome of ancient times in terms of the most powerful entity in the earth. And you could even say the United States is, you know, you could argue that it's an extension of ancient Rome. But again, ancient Rome in the first century, it was the great pagan persecuting anti-Israel, anti-Zion, anti-Semitic entity in the earth. And they were worshiping demons as part of their national religion. You know, the United States, again, for all of its faults, simply is not, in that sense, the neo-Rome, if you will, of the last days.
Well, what about the possibility of Babylon having been a reference to a kingdom that's already passed, maybe going back to the fall of Rome or some other entities that have fallen throughout history? What would be some of the arguments in that direction?
Well, that's what's called the preterist interpretation, and really, of that, within that, some are going to say it was Rome, some are going to say it was Jerusalem in 70 AD. There are significant problems with it. First of all, Babylon falls and it's destroyed, annihilated forever.
Right.
That simply didn't happen in history. You know, Rome did not fall to be annihilated forever. Instead, quite to the contrary, it was sort of infected, if you will, with Christianity, and it continues to this day, and it certainly hasn't been annihilated. It's not just a heaping, smoking heap of ruins and a nest for owls and desert animals and this sort of thing. Likewise, Jerusalem simply doesn't fit because Babylon is described as being an entity that will be destroyed forever. And, you know, throughout the scriptures, the overwhelming descriptions of the return of Jesus is that he will come back and place his throne in Jerusalem forever. And this is the city that God has put his name on.
Sure.
So to try to say on one hand, Jesus is going to rule from there forever, on the other hand, it's going to be destroyed forever, you just have a glaring contradiction there.
Yeah, good point. Well, and what about the beast? This is kind of interesting. In verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. And there's another reference in the following verse about you will see the beast that he was and is not and will come. Is there an eternal component there to the beast? How are we to interpret that?
Well, that part is definitely tricky, but essentially it's referring to, because it goes on and it says, those who at the time, in the last days, see the beast that was and comes back. So this is from the vantage point, not of the first century, but actually the last days, because those alive will see the beast as he comes back. And what it's actually referencing is the seventh head of this beast with seven heads. So after Rome, because Rome was the sixth, there's another head that comes, and then it says the seventh head suffers this fatal head wound, and then it comes back as an eighth. And so, again, it's a bit of a riddle, but as I have argued elsewhere, I genuinely believe the only empire in history that follows the pattern of all of these previous pagan empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, is the Islamic Empire.
Yeah.
It carries all of those same criteria. I think that we saw it fall in 1923 when that empire was dissolved. And I believe we're seeing it in the early stages of its revival, that we'll see the full-blown revival of the Islamic Empire in the last days. And so the woman is in clear relationship with that final anti-Christic empire, whichever it may be.
Well, it is fascinating. We want to unpack more of this with Joel Richardson. When we come back, his book, Mystery Babylon. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Back in a moment. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, a biblical response to the queering of the church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Just one example of a mom who came in, was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her. And she said, I just can't allow this baby to be killed, for her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Joel Richardson, Bible prophecy expert, and on Islam in the Middle East as well. His book is called Mystery Babylon, Unlocking the Bible's Greatest Prophetic Mystery. We're unpacking Revelation 17 and 18, a very confusing passage for many of us. But you raise this point, Joel, which I think has a lot of merit to it, that really we should be looking at the Islamic world. You specifically bring up Mecca and Saudi Arabia as potential fulfillments of this prophecy. How come? Tell us why you think that's where we should be looking potentially.
Well, essentially what we're looking for, and again, we have the pattern in the past. We have the pattern of ancient Babylon. It was the spiritual capital of the reigning beast empire of Babylon. During the first century, we had Rome. That was really the second pattern. Today, if indeed the Islamic empire is that final beast empire, then the spiritual and financial capital of that empire is Mecca, and in a larger sense, the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It meets the criteria of being those two elements, the religious and the economic, the political. When we look at the influence of Saudi Arabia today, you say, what is the single greatest lobby, what is the single greatest influence in Washington financially? And it is a single family, a single foreign government, the Saudi royal family. Yeah. We've seen, of course, with the Clintons, they opened up their files. They had $30 million directly given to them by the Saudi royal family, $100 million from Saudi Gulf Arabs. With the Bushes, it's actually far, far, far more than that, closer to $1.5 billion. Same thing with Jimmy Carter, various presidents. You think of this, a foreign government. And this just so happens to be the government in the earth that is also responsible for the ideological and financial spread of the most violent, radical, anti-Christic, wicked form of Islam that has ever existed. That, whether it's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, any of these groups, that is Salafi or Wahhabi Islam. It comes from Saudi Arabia. They pay for it. They spread it all over the earth. We are always told that Iran is the greatest source of national funding for terrorism. Hands down, it's Saudi Arabia. Right. Why will no one talk about it? Because they own Washington. And I believe that, you know, when you walk through all of the criteria with this interpretation, it actually seems to make far better sense than any of the other interpretations that have been suggested.
Well, and what about the mosque funding? Because we have mosques being built in, at greater pace all the time here in the United States, and there's a lot of Saudi money behind those mosques. What's their deal? Why are they doing that?
Well, I mean, it is quite literally the single greatest evangelistic campaign in the history of mankind. Now, I throw out some figures in the book. The Southern Baptist Convention, the IMB, is the largest Protestant missions organization in the world. They've got about $300 million each year they're spending to spread the gospel. You throw in some other groups like Wycliffe, the Assemblies of God, YWAM. Altogether, we've got about $1.5 billion that we're spending globally to spread the gospel. The Saudis spend that much about every 3 months, and they have done so for the past 40 years to spread not just Islam, but again, Wahhabi Islam. And they do it. They build the mosques. They build the Islamic centers. They train the preachers. They train the hate preachers. They send them out. They fill the mosques with the radical literature that's anti-Israel, anti-American, and yet we allow them to do that. Why? Because at the very top of our government, not just presidents, but anyone who is in office knows that if they play ball with the Saudis, when they get out, they'll get some cushy job sitting on a board, you know, a consulting position, a couple $100,000 a year for doing next to nothing. And they have literally bought Washington, and not just Washington, but numerous governments all over the earth.
Well, and as many people have pointed out, we had Saudis who were part of the 9/11 attack on the United States. And many people say, well, why don't we do anything about Saudi Arabia? And they attribute it just to oil. But yes, this is very difficult. What about when we look at the passage, though, on the issue of persecuting Christians? People will say, well, you know, ISIS is persecuting Christians. Boko Haram is persecuting Christians. We see all these violent groups in the Middle East. And yes, you can't have a church on the Arabian Peninsula. But if you go to Saudi Arabia, they'll tolerate you a little bit if you're from, you know, out of the country and you have to work there or something. How can you make the case that there's Christian persecution tied to Saudi Arabia? What would you say to that?
Well, again, Saudi Arabia is not only the ideological womb, the ideological fountain for ISIS, but it's also the financial womb. If you didn't have Saudi Arabia, you wouldn't have ISIS. You wouldn't have Al-Qaeda. You wouldn't have Boko Haram killing Nigerians, blowing up churches. You wouldn't have Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Abu Sayyaf in Philippines. Any of these various, all of the worst terrorist groups all find their ideological foundation in Saudi Arabia. And so when we look at right now, the top roughly 20, except for North Korea, roughly the top 20 of the worst persecuting nations in the earth toward Christians are all Islamic nations. And the majority of those specifically have come under the influence of this propaganda evangelistic campaign that has emanated out of Saudi Arabia for the past 40 years. And again, you know, I understand this is a fairly novel interpretation if no one's considered it, but the reason no one talks about it, what does the woman say? She says, I sit as queen. I will not be a widow. No one sees me. Why does no one talk about it? Again, because money buys silence, and that's exactly what it's done in our nation.
Goodness. Well, what about Babylon falling, if this is consistent with what you're putting forward here about Mecca, Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Empire, rebirth, and all the rest? Eventually, Babylon will fall, and it talks a lot about the immorality. It says this in both Revelation chapter 17 and also chapter 18, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. I think that is, you know, generally when I've heard people talking about that passage, they'll say, oh, that's why it has to be the United States, because we're so decadent. How would you take the immorality aspect? Obviously, terrorism is moral. Would that be an explanation for the immorality references if you link it to Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's, you know, there's different terms for that. Fornication, harlotry, essentially what virtually any commentator will say if you, you know, read various commentaries on Revelation is that that is speaking of idolatry. It's speaking of false worship. So it uses sexual immorality as a metaphor for idolatry. And this woman is specifically the great harlot. Hmm. She's not simply one of many, you know, negative influences in the earth. She is the greatest. She is the big mama. She is the mother of all harlots. And, of course, Islam is the single greatest false worship system in the history of mankind. Numerically, nothing has ever come close. 1.61 billion people, fastest growing religion in the earth right now, largely because of birth rates. The city of Mecca, the shrine, the Kaaba, this pagan shrine that sits in that city, is the single most visited spot in the entire earth. Every day, people bow down toward that great idol. It is the greatest idol that mankind has ever produced.
Right. That's right. So Babylon will be destroyed. And it says they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, whoa, whoa, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth. This also touches on some aspects that you mentioned in the book, the fact that it's a desert location, it seems, and a port city. So this would also give you some more evidence.
Yeah, well, I mean, he says, I was taken out into, some translations say wilderness, it's Eremon in the biblical world, it's always a desert. So the woman is pictured as being in a desert, and we have no reason to see that as anything other than literal, because the angel never says, the desert means this.
Right.
He just says, I saw the woman in the desert, and she seems to be described as a port city, and I talk about the fact that while the city of Mecca is, I think, about 48 miles inland, almost exactly the same distance as Rome is, the city of Jeddah sits immediately to the west of Mecca, and they are now building both Jeddah and King Abdullah Economic City just to the north to become the greatest seaport in the whole Middle East. They're pumping billions of dollars into that. They're putting up the world's new tallest building, and they're trying to create essentially a mega city. They'll all be linked by this high-speed train. You can get from one to the other in about 20 minutes or so. And I think in the days ahead, we're going to see sort of a mixture between Dubai and a great city of idolatry, a great technologically advanced port city right there on the Red Sea of Saudi Arabia.
So when you look at this particular passage then, Joel, does this indicate to you that Islam will establish its caliphate throughout the earth, that eventually that goal will become a reality?
Well, it seems to indicate something along that line. Of course, you know, ISIS established their little caliphate. And interestingly, what I've been seeing in the news the past year or two is I've seen Western analysts, Middle Eastern analysts, say, you know, I think what we've learned from ISIS is they say the Muslims want a caliphate. But this is what they've said, is they've said, but we need a moderate caliphate. And in fact, they say most of the problems in the world, in the Middle East, are because of the lack of a caliphate. When we had a Turkish empire, the Middle East was stable. It's really been unstable ever since the Western colonizing powers came in and broke it up. Maybe we do need a caliphate. We just need it to be controlled by a more moderate caliph, if you will, or leader. And so, you know, I do believe that in the days ahead, we'll see that. You know, there's a Turkish saying. It says, if you show the people death, they will happily embrace malaria. And I think we've seen ISIS, and most people want nothing to do with that. But when a slightly less devious alternative is set forward, people seem to flock to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't think our chances of a moderate caliphate are very good, would you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and they always begin, and this is the nature of the Antichrist, is he begins with a faith of moderation. In fact, the Antichrist will have some political capital in the beginning, but very quickly he shows his true colors by the middle of the final 7 years.
Yes, that's right. Well, as you mentioned, this is such an important section of prophecy for people to really understand and pray over and to understand what is coming. And the glorious truth is that Jesus is coming as well. Well, Joel Richardson, great book, Mystery Babylon. Joel, thank you so much. It was great to have you back.
Thank you, Janet. Lord bless you.
Thank you. You too. We'll be back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. I think if I had a penny for every mainstream media diatribe against evangelicals that I've read in the last 2 years, I could retire handsomely. Because every day it seems some media outlet is lamenting that evangelicals have either sold their souls to Trump, or they hate women, or they despise justice. It's just overwhelming. And meanwhile, the woke evangelicals are endlessly praised and admired in some of these same sources. And my next guest really nails what is going on here in a recent piece at the Washington Times. What gives journalists the moral or religious yard stick by which to measure evangelicals? Great question. And I'm joined now by Dr. Daryl Hart, Distinguished Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. So great to have you here, Dr. Hart. How are you?
Great. Good to be with you again. Thanks.
Yeah, good to talk to you too. So your piece has this headline, Painting Evangelicals as Hypocrites. And I'm wondering what you have actually observed about journalists going after evangelicals for immorality of all types.
Well, I've noticed, the same way that you have over the last 2 years, journalists quoting the Bible at different times or claiming this is what Jesus taught or something in order to show the folly or the moral waywardness of evangelicals. And, I think it's possible to criticize lots of people in the church on biblical grounds. It's just very ironic when journalists do it when, in fact, most of the time, I don't think they necessarily mock the Bible, but it's not as if the Bible is in their toolkit as something that they usually appeal to analyze current events or public policy or something. So, when it fits with a kind of gotcha way out there right now, and if you can skewer evangelicals on their home turf with the Bible, so much more so. But it just is. It's at least ironic, if not amazingly hypocritical, if not also just a window into our current moment.
Yeah, it is. And it ramped up substantially, I think people will notice, over the last 2 years. Why in the Trump era did they all of a sudden ramp this up to 11? Because they've always kind of tried to pick on evangelicals to some extent and try to catch them in hypocritical moments or positions that weren't consistent. And you're right, they never used the Bible as the yardstick for anything else at any other time, it seems. But why did the Trump era kick this off to such a high degree, do you think?
Right. I think in some ways it's not that tough a question in the sense that President Trump is not the most morally upstanding of people, and he doesn't even, I think most presidents have not necessarily been morally upstanding people. It's just that they tried to play or cast themselves a different way, but President Trump really hasn't tried to do that, and he has a lot of history of not being very moral Christian, however you want to put it. And so to see evangelicals rallying around him, again, it depends on who you're watching, because not obviously a lot of evangelicals did not rally to him. A number of prominent evangelicals, people like Russell Moore or other names are escaping me right now, but were critical. So, and they've also receive a lot of favorable press in this context. But Trump, it seems to me, explains almost everything right now. And so if you can skewer the people who've supported him, and the number that is always repeated is 81%, even though a lot of social scientists, historians, and other people have begun to parse those numbers, and they don't always mean what they allegedly mean, but it's just one more way, it seems to me, to denounce the president. And again, I think there are lots of reasons why President Trump could be criticized, but I've never seen in my lifetime a president have to undergo this kind of moral denunciation. He's invited it in some ways, but in other ways, there's almost no respect for the office, no respect for the political process, no respect for the social order that in some ways the presidency is responsible for keeping up.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. And it's sort of interesting. One of the people you mentioned in your article at the Washington Times is Michael Gerson. And I've been keeping kind of a close eye on what he writes in the Washington Post. He seems to be the number one guy who is writing articles, at least in terms of frequency, on how evangelicals have sold their souls to Trump. Evangelicals have given up, you know, all their principles. They've done this and they've done that. And for so many Christians I speak to, as you mentioned, evangelicals have had different views on Trump and when they decided to support him or not support him. But generally, those I've spoken to have said, well, I would have preferred somebody else in the lineup on the GOP side, but it ended up being Trump because I certainly didn't want to vote for Hillary. She's pro-abortion, she's pro-LGBT, all these things. But there consistently seems to be this attack on evangelicals that all of them have sold their souls simply for voting for who they thought would be the better candidate over Hillary Clinton. And that seems to be a narrative that's never been quite corrected in the media.
Right. So a couple lines to that, it seems to me, in the case of Michael Gerson, is one is, and I see this a lot with people in my field of religious history and other evangelical academics, where I think there's an effort in this context with the media as critical of evangelicals for their hypocrisy as the media is, for media figures to this to say, I'm not that kind of evangelical, and therefore criticize evangelicals in very similar categories as the press may be for evangelical hypocrisy. But the other wrinkle that really annoys me about Mr. Gerson is that he was a speechwriter for George W. Bush, and the press was not kind to President Bush,
right,
or to his especially the war in Iraq, but even the way he handled the financial crisis, the beginning of it. And so for Gerson to go out of his way to criticize the president and his supporters and not sort of recognize that he's doing precisely what the press was doing to his president and even to the administration of which he was a part, I don't quite understand that. And it seems to me at that point there's something more than just kind of failing to remember something, but there may be more to it. I don't want to speculate on motives too much, but it just doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't. And you know what's interesting to me is sometimes you'll see Gerson saying things at the same time in the Washington Post that some of the more woke evangelicals are pushing at their own conferences or pushing in their own articles that they're writing. And they're all friends. And some of these people are friends. So there are a lot of Christians who say, well, wait a minute now. Is there this unhealthy blend of media figures with more liberal, more progressive evangelicals now? Is that becoming more of a thing?
I think it is. I mean, the way that social media platforms are working, but even just the way that I think, the way media outlets work in general. I mean, if you can get a bigger name person on a show or as a source in your story or for a quotation, it makes more sense.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Gerson has a kind of standing at the Washington Post. And a lot of progressive evangelicals have oftentimes academic appointments or other kinds of successful ministries. But it winds up creating this problem of the bubble, which is partly what was responsible for producing President Trump. And people inside the bubble didn't actually appreciate the way at least many Americans, sufficient to get President Trump elected, were thinking about these things.
Yeah.
So it seems that the problem is repeating itself, and I think it actually makes, in some ways, President Trump look better to the people who voted for him, because no one else is really coming around to understanding the reasons why people voted for him in the first place, especially if the only reasons are going to be racism, misogyny, and all these things.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange phenomenon, But it's really surprising, to go back to the original point, the way that the mainstream media, especially editors at the Post, I think that New York Times have been less so, but the way those outlets, but even Atlantic and other places, have promoted people writing about evangelicalism the way that they have.
Yeah, they have. And there's been an uptick, I think, in a lot of these personal first-person narratives. I've seen a lot of those, too. I want to get your take on that. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be coming back with Dr. Daryl Hart from Hillsdale College, talking about his Washington Times piece, Painting Evangelicals as Hypocrites. You're listening to Janet Meffer Today. Back in a moment. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. How much is one life worth? Most of us would say life is priceless, and we'd be right. After all, what is the value of someone created in the image of God? We're asking Janet Mefford Today listeners, just like you, to help us save babies through the ministry of Preborn. How does Preborn save babies? Through ultrasounds. Preborn works with hundreds of pro-life pregnancy centers across America, providing free ultrasounds for women in crisis pregnancies. And 80% of the time, when a mother sees her little baby on an ultrasound, she'll choose life. It's that easy. We need your help to support the vital work of Preborn in saving human lives. For your gift of $28, you can provide a free ultrasound to a mom in a crisis pregnancy. And for a gift of $140, you can provide 5 ultrasounds to 5 mothers. All you have to do is call 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you for saving a baby's life. Back on Janet Mefford Today, my guest, Michael Abbott Jr. He is the author of Entitled to Slavery, a Blueprint for Breaking the Chains that Threaten American Exceptionalism. And one of the things that also is really important, Michael, I think, to talk about is what you stress regarding public school education. This is a show in and of itself, obviously. But how do you look at public school education these days as having a role in our demise?
I would say if you look at early 1960s, the two pinnacle Supreme Court cases that basically threw prayer and the Bible out of school, what we're trying to do now, and this is 5 decades now we're working on this, so I would say it's at least 3 generations of Americans who have been raised without a biblical worldview.
Yeah.
We think that we can achieve wisdom without truth. And that is, to me, very dangerous. And as you get to the end of the book, you'll see I highlight some of the merits of homeschooling, which, to be honest, is the most tried and true form of education ever known to man.
Yeah.
Yet we're trying to, again, the Department of Education, which is always in the news, just came about in the 1970s. I mean, this is only 40 years ago that we have the Department of Education. And now people truly think that if we were to either abolish it, not that I'm claiming we do that, but if we were to deviate from it, that all of a sudden education falls apart and we can't teach our children basic core concepts. I think that's just nonsense.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And homeschooling really can be a good tool to be able to bring, most importantly, a biblical worldview to our kids.
Yeah, it certainly does. And again, just to finish off my thoughts, so not only do our schools not teach the gospel anymore, but they also refuse to provide a basic understanding of financial literacy, and they don't teach our kids the merits of civic responsibility. So they're not ascribing to an absolute standard of morality, and they generally avoid disciplining students out of fear of legal reprisal. So.
Yeah.
When we subvert this classical academic curriculum that we're all used to, and we start exaggerating the importance of things like sexual preference, which you hinted at before the break, that's well outside the scope of any academic curriculum, and it doesn't really raise our children to be ready and prepared to experience the trials and tribulations of adulthood.
No, that's right. Exactly. Now, what do you think about the church and the church's culpability in the degraded state of our culture? Because you say it is the church that drives the culture. The church, I would say, is not in a very healthy state at the moment. What are your observations about where the church may have dropped the ball along the way?
I think the church now operates under a hybrid battery, and I think your listeners can really resonate with this point. When you just think about an electric car, you know, that's all the rage now, these cars that can just almost figuratively shut down at traffic lights and then start up again. To me, the engine that is within all of us is the Holy Spirit. That is the absolute truth that we all have. But what the church has gone into a slippery slope now is when we experience a sinful delicacy, we disengage our engine, which is the Spirit, and lean on our own understanding, which is human compassion. So what we're doing now is we're now perverting the true gospel, and what it essentially does is it enables our sinful behavior and then turns the new adherence to our faith into agents of our own destruction. So you talk about, and there's a lot I covered there, obviously. There's a lot of meat there. But that's, our church is going towards this direction, and as a result, you talk about totalitarianism and the rise of the state. It's either the state that is the absolute authority or it's God. There's no in-between. You know, so you think of a pendulum. It's going one side to the other. And clearly we're swinging back towards man, and that's unhealthy. And the churches that are growing fastest today are those ones that are not watering down the gospel.
How long do you think we'll be able to maintain that fidelity, though? I think about that every single day as you see different denominations falling on certain issues that the church previously would never have caved on, homosexuality and these sorts of things. Where would you say we are on the scale of fidelity? Which way are we leaning at the moment? More in the apostasy direction or more in the fidelity direction?
Apostasy. That's a very hard thing to say. But what I'm trying to do is wake up my brothers and sisters, because there are things that we can do that can take not just the power back. This isn't a power struggle, but to just advance the true gospel. There's always something being evangelized through the culture. Always something. And if it's not the gospel of Christ, it's something else. But you talk about the church driving the culture. And I just ask, the questions I ask are, what happened first? Did the school throw the Bible out of the school, or did the American home throw the Bible out of the home first?
Wow.
Or, for example, gay marriage. You talk about what came first, the Supreme Court decision in 2015, or I think it was the Episcopal Church, homosexual bishop in 2003, the Presbyterian Church, you know, ordained gay marriage into its church constitution. There's a litany of things that happened first in the church, and then the culture picked it up. So, again, it's not like the church is driven by the culture. The church drives the culture.
Right. Well, you have a really stinging indictment here. You say when the church cannot tolerate the gospel of Jesus Christ, neither will the culture. Is it your assessment that in a majority way, the church is not really tolerating the gospel of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, here's where you get into a bit of a danger, and I want to be careful with my answer because I'm not throwing stones. But what I'm trying to encourage us to do is there is a time-tested truth that has supported everything that is good about human civilization. Liberty and freedom, that starts with the Bible and an understanding of Christ's teachings. And we're afraid of it now. And it's to our own demise, because the more years that go by, it almost seems like there's another story. It's almost like tomorrow or next week we can expect something else is going to happen as far as an erosion of our basic liberties and freedoms. So I talked about the minimum wage and how that's an assault on our right to liberty. But, I mean, we need to start talking about the assault on human life that's going on and placing an importance. And why is it so important that we address this issue of abortion head on? Because this cannot stand if we want to be a civil society.
So true. So true. Well, you say to realize the fundamental restoration of our country, Christians have to have these two directives and satisfy these directives. One is uniting the entire church community of believers to incorporate their faith into every aspect of their lives, no matter the cost. That's great. And I agree completely. How do we move toward that?
Well, you know what we do is, I think one of the biggest steps, and people don't appreciate this, but you talk about the metaphor of seeds and fruits. And we look at fruit a lot, but we don't oftentimes look at seeds. And again, I'm going to go back to your LGBT-themed content before the break, where how did the court effectively pass the legislation for gay marriage? In 2013, there was a study that showed that the Fox Network featured 42% of its programming featured LGBT-themed content.
Huh.
And ABC Family, right?
Yep.
50%. So you start talking about, this is what people are seeing, and Chapter 5 of my book is entirely directed to the media and this reconstructed reality that we judge life based on what we see, not based on reality. And so the study revealed that we're inflating these statistics by like 1,700%, basically, and it results in people, you know, in 2003, that by and large, the majority of people in our culture did not believe in homosexual marriage and the merits therein. 2015, that is, I think, an overwhelming majority now do.
Yeah.
So we're planting seeds into a device that is essentially serving as a system of evangelism for a secular narrative, and that's basically what we do when we turn on the television.
Exactly.
So trying to just warn people that, you know, you just have to be careful. You look at some of these verses in Scripture, Romans 12:2, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Yeah. Psalm 101, verse 3, do not look with approval on anything that is vile. We have to take these to heart, and this explains that, I mean, the Bible is more alive today than it ever was.
Amen. Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, this has been the whole plan all along. If you go back to that seminal work in the late 80s after the ball, and it was how the gay culture is going to overtake society, and they had a whole game plan. That was part of it, was to be able to put a lot of gay material on TV and sympathetic characters, and then we'll mm-hmm. break down people's morals. There was never an actual persuasive argument on this. It was just propaganda.
That's exactly right. And there always appeals to your emotion.
Always.
Every time that
yep.
they're appealing to you, a secular humanist or a progressive, it's always an appeal to your emotion. But what I want is, I want to stay on this television topic just one more time, because, again, people are like, what, turn off the TV? That's really part of the solution? Let me just share my story, and I hope it resonates. I shut off the television from my home about 5 or 6 years ago, and I have a toddler at home. I have an infant son. I have a full-time job. I've written this book. Nature abhors a vacuum. So when you take something like that out of the culture, first of all, you're not planting those seeds out of your own resources anymore. But since nature abhors a vacuum, you're going to fill it with something else. And for me, I've never had a better walk with Christ. I've never been more productive with my time. And now what I'm trying to do is share these solutions with my brothers and sisters and say, hey, you know, the world tells you that what are you going to do about our problems? You're just one person. That's from the father of lies.
Right.
I mean, the surprisingly simple steps we can take, everything requires you. We need you to make
yes.
some of these changes. And again, I'm talking about television. We talk about homeschooling. But there's even a solution in the book that shows conservative business leaders a strategy to survive and thrive by simply employing a strategy that led us out of the Cold War. So it's a really compelling read as far as here's some things that you can tangibly do that are going to advance and restore American exceptionalism.
Excellent. Well, the name of the book is entitled To Slavery, Michael Abbott Jr., abbottspeaks.com, his website. Michael, it was just wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Janet. Have a great day.
You too. God bless you. Thanks for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. As always, our website is janetmefford.com. We'll see you there.